Welcome to the Spirituality of Strength Training with your host, Anna Willard. This podcast is dedicated to bring you knowledge, wisdom, inspiration, and guidance to wherever you may be on your health journey. For those who are new to me, I am a kettlebell strength coach, a movement nerd ninja, and an empowerment coach on a mission to bring you hope through our health. The root word of health comes from wholeness. The root word of wholeness comes from holy. Despite our differences with religion and spiritual beliefs, we are all human beings with a body that is designed to reflect this holiness through our health. It wasn't until my 7th year as a health profession where I went into a deep awakening of understanding what does it mean to train my spirit and to heal my spirit through the physical. You'll hear a little bit more about my story from other health professionals, from strength coaches, psychiatrists, spiritual gurus and leaders, to other people who talk about the importance of our health as a community body and the health of our planet as well. This podcast is to allow us to step into our whole health, mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Thank you for being here. If you love what you hear, I encourage you to subscribe. If you want more inspiration and quotes from these podcasts, I encourage you to follow me on Instagram at Anna_Willard_. I encourage you to do a little bit of a movement, either a yoga flow, go for a walk, sit in nature, as you enjoy this episode. Hey, Strong Ones, welcome to today's episode. Today, we literally have the brains on the show with Allison Madtech. She is a neuroscientist. She has her postdoctorate research science. So she's a postdoctorate research scientist in the Department of Psychology at University of Oregon, and she's working in the Computational Social Neuroscience Lab. She received her PhD from the Psychology and Brain Science of Dartmouth College. Allison, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to share what I know. I'm going to talk a little bit about the brain and in particular how the body is represented by the brain. I know you do a lot of body work, and so I thought that would be a nice focus. And I'll just kind of walk through the slides. And of course, if you have any questions as I go through, just please feel free to stop me and we can... We can kind of meander. However it feels good.
So for those who are just listening, I would encourage you to click the watch button down in the show notes where you can go to the YouTube channel and watch the slides that Allison is going to be talking about. So what Allison is going to dive in with first is just explaining how, where that brain-body connection is and how intertwined our brain is with our body. I had a guest earlier today who, or I was doing all my interviews for this month, he was talking about like the brain and the body are never disconnected. Like we think of it as like a truck and then like a U-Haul in the back where like, no, it's all one thing. So yeah. I'm really excited to learn from what you have to share. I'm gonna see how I can share my slides or the slides. Should have done this. Here we go. Perfect. You should be able to see this as well. Here Perfect. We go. Present.
Nice.
It's loading.
Great. So I titled this A Little Bit of Brain Anatomy, just because, you know, brain anatomy is such a big topic.
Yes.
I'm just going to, you know, focus on just a little tidbits, hopefully that hopefully people find it useful or informative. So yeah, you can go to the first slide. And I wanted to start with a picture of the brain inside the head. Mm-hmm. As you said, the brain is a part of the body. It's another organ. And what's interesting is, you know, the brain is kind of responsible for our ability to sense, to have a sense of feeling in our body, the sense of touch, and just perceiving our body. And actually, what's interesting is that there's actually no, there's no sense of touch in the brain. So if somebody were actually poking around in your brain, you wouldn't be able to feel it. Because the neurons there, the neurons there are doing something completely different. But all of these sort of mechanisms in the periphery, the little receptors in our skin, just all over the body, are all coming up into the brain through there. But the brain itself doesn't, you don't really have a sensation of feeling there. So
it's fascinating.
Yeah. So I think it's just to see the brain pictured like that, it's just a reminder that, you know, it's another organ, and it's like, the whole body is represented inside the body within the brain. And so I'll just talk a little bit more about where in the brain that happens. And so brain anatomy is sort of like geography, you know, the geography of the brain. Certain things have certain labels, and we can think about what happens in these different regions. So you can go ahead and go to the next slide.
Real quick, this image reminds me of something I saw on Facebook, and it was an image similar to this, but it was the effect of our heartbeat on the brain, and how our heartbeat gave like a pulse to the brain. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, well, I would say certainly the heartbeat is going to be important for brain activity. I mean, the circulatory system feeds the brain with oxygen, and all the neurons in the brain need oxygen in order to do their function. And actually, with whenever a neuron is more active than it usually is, if it starts to sort of increase its activity, it's going to ask the circulatory system for more oxygen. And so the brain is in constant connection with the whole circulatory system, and that's dependent on the heart rate. And yeah, you could actually see fluctuations in certain brain regions that are consistent with the heart rate, just because that's how the brain can do its thing. It really needs oxygen in order to do it.
Well, and I thought it was just fascinating. I'll see if I can put it in the show notes, if I can dig it up again on Facebook. But I thought it was fascinating to see this organ have the same rhythm as the heart. I think it was maybe like when they were exercising or something, but it was fascinating because a lot of times we think, oh, the heart is the only thing that really beats, but it affects the rest of our body and the rhythm of that.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
All right. We'll head on to the next slide. Oh, do I need to keep clicking?
Yeah, you can click one more. That's good.
Okay.
So the cortex is, it's sort of divided into different colors here. And these are the different lobes of the brain, but you can see that there's all these folds and creases. Mm-hmm. And so the creases are called, any crease is called a sulcus. A sulcus is just another word for a valley. And those sulci is the plural. They kind of go deep in there. This one here that I have labeled the central sulcus is kind of important. It divides the yellow frontal lobe from the pink, which is called the parietal lobe. The labels are not so important. I think I just kind of want to give people an idea of where things are. But the central
sulcus, this is good.
It's going to divide. It's right behind it in that pink region. You can go to the next slide. Is where your sense of touch sort of comes in. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole representation of the body here. Anytime you touch sort of or something touches your body. Whether your finger or your knee or anywhere, that signal is going to sort of travel up through the spinal cord. And the first place where it gets to the cortex is right here, which is called the primary somatosensory cortex, which is responsible for the sense of touch. So if we zoom in a little bit more to that strip, so you can go to the next. Oh, yeah, just before I go there, the other lobes of the brain are sort of governed by different sensory modalities. So I'll go back. I'll talk about these a little bit because obviously in the visual system, which is in the back of the brain and other sense of sight, there's actually also a representation of the body there because we see our body and we see other people's body. Mm-hmm. So I'll point that out sort of as we go later on. And then of course the temporal lobe, which is in the green, that's sort of more responsible for our sense of hearing. That's where the all the messages from the ear comes in. So the brain is sort of divided by, you know, what sort of input is coming in to that part of the brain. And I would say, yeah, the body is, you know, the sense of touch is sort of what people associate with a sense of having a body. Although the body is definitely going to be represented in visual cortex as well. And as well as the yellow frontal lobe. So we'll get to that too.
Okay.
So yeah, so if we go and kind of zoom into the primary somatosensory cortex, you can see like that whole strip is divided into little segments. Segment is representing a particular part of the body, and it's not really, you know, you can see how funky this little guy looks.
Yeah.
But
and this is called the homunculus, is that right?
Homunculus, yeah, yes. Very good. I meant to put that word on
no,
here.
No, it's all good. So, I'm going to jump in real quick. So the listeners, you probably have heard me reference this before. So if you're listening, I would encourage you to go and watch so you can see what I have referred to as like if our hands and our feet and the end of our neurons were as big as our muscles, this is a really good image of understanding our nerve endings in that sensory. And then it shows a really good picture of where it's happening in the brain. And I'll hand it back off to you, Allison.
Cool. Yeah. So it's sort of interesting to see the different, you know, how much sensitivity there is in these different parts of the body. And really, it requires so much sophisticated sensory experience in order to speak. And there's just such refined movements involved in speaking and in the different things that we do with our hands. And so you can see that the mouth and the tongue and the hands are pretty much the most densely represented, or that they have the sort of largest amount of real estate. And it really has to do with the kind of sensitivity that is required in order to do the things that we do with those parts of our body. This kind of representation, I mean, I would think that there are some sort of individual differences here. So for example, you can see that there are different segments for each of the fingers. But for example, if you were, you know, like a concert piano player, your representation for each finger would probably be a little bit larger than in the average person, basically because you spend so much time concentrating on that part of the body and have this really sophisticated representation of the sensation there. And so it's kind of interesting to see, you know, when you see this picture, you can see how distorted the size of the representations are. But I have this inclination, and I kind of wonder for people who are really experienced with body training, whether it's yoga or strength training or something like that, if there's actually a little bit more balance in that representation, and perhaps, you know, people who spend more time, you know, because you can imagine somebody who just has a desk job, they are probably not paying attention to their body as much as someone who's, you know, in the gym every day or does that as a career. Yeah, I think that that's sort of an area for exploration is how this representation can change. I mean, we know it can change with experience, just to what degree is sort of the question. And it's all, you can, obviously it's guided by attention. And so the more that you're, in the example of the concert pianist, the more you're attending to that part of the body, you're kind of growing your representation. And you could imagine, or I would theorize that if the opposite is true and say you're avoiding paying attention to a particular part of your body, perhaps if there was an injury or some sort of trauma, you could imagine that there's also some distortion in the representation that happens there. So I think those are some things that aren't, people's representation of their body is different from everybody else is something that sort of, still needs to be explored a little bit more, but certainly I, you know, when I'm doing, you know, some yoga practice or anything, I try to, I like to think about this representation and kind of think about where my brain, and where my brain am I working on as
interesting.
My body. So I think, this is a really interesting representation to think about as you sense things coming yeah. from the body.
Yeah. Well, and you answered a question I was going to ask, was just like, if you could train that, like if you can train that motor skill with the hands, with like what you gave the example of like the piano player mm-hmm. versus those who aren't. So I think, I would hypothesize with you. I was just like, yes, it seems like you could.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Are we good to go on to the next slide?
Oh yeah. 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 Okay. Yeah. So, you know, right across on the other side of that valley that we had labeled before the central sulcus, uh-huh. You have the primary motor cortex, and these neurons here in this strip, these are actually mm-hmm. the largest neurons in the central nervous system that live here. And they project all the way down the spinal cord and all the way to the muscles. And because that signal has to be so fast, is why the neurons are so big and they can handle that sort of speed. And I have there the word willful movement, just because the body has a lot of different types of movement. And so when you get like, you know, tremors like in Parkinson's disease or something like that, that movement is sort of governed by a different part of the brain that's sort of lower and below cortex. Okay. But this part of the brain, if you intentionally say, you know, I want to pick up this cup right now, or just the way I'm moving my hands right now.
Yeah.
It's going to be, these neurons are sort of required for sending that signal down to the body. And, there's actually a pretty large, going back to the circulatory system, there's a large artery that comes up in there. And
that makes sense.
Yep. Yeah. And so when people have, people who suffer from a stroke, if they lose their ability to move their face, for example, that's due to the damage in these neurons right here. And they can no longer sort of willfully control that movement. It comes back over time for a lot of people with therapy, but yeah, that has to do with those neurons are required. They have to be functioning and receiving yeah. oxygen in order for you to control the movements of your body. Mm-hmm. So you can go ahead to the next slide.
One quick question. So
oh, yeah.
mm-hmm. These are like more of the willful movements. Is that as long as like go along with like strength training as well?
Yeah. 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 I mean, anything where it's sort of like you're consciously deciding to do that movement. So anything that the body does where you kind of didn't plan it, you know, like if you like hiccup or something, that's going to be a different system. But yeah, anything where you're choosing to lift that weight or to
right.
do that, so that's going to all be in this domain. Yeah.
So this may be a stupid question, but I know you mentioned like these are the most, is it dense or thick neurons?
They're physically the biggest. I mean, they're long, like they can be up to like meters long,
and
they have that long tail that goes all the way down through the spinal cord.
And you mentioned the reason for that function is because they have to send that impulse very rapidly. Is it also just because it's like a bigger part of our body that we're moving?
Yeah, I would say that's true as well. Certainly.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just the energy that's required to make that
right.
movement in yeah. such a rapid time. Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. Are we good to go on?
Yeah.
All right.
Yep. So here it's just sort of you have the homunculus on both sides, and this uh-huh. is just to demonstrate that sort of symmetry. The motor cortex is right in front of the somatosensory cortex, and obviously that sulcus is dividing the two. But you can see, you know, however, as you move, you can feel the movement. And mm-hmm. so these two regions are nice and close, and they're sort of tied to each other. So that you can, you know, it would be really hard basically to move around if you didn't have that immediate feedback.
Right.
These two parts of the brain are nicely situated really close to each other. So you can sort of experience that synchrony. So yeah, just everything, you know, the way that your body represents movement and represents mm-hmm. feeling, it has this sort of mirror relationship that's sort of nicely illustrated right here in that.
Right. Side. Just going back and forth. Is it almost like just like they're communicating back and forth?
Oh yeah. There's a lot of connection between those neurons. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Definitely. This is so good.
Cool. I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Yeah, this is great. I need that Root Anatomy refresher.
Nice. Good, good. Yeah, so this is another important sort of valley in the brain called the lateral sulcus, which is sort of dividing the green temporal lobe off from the other two lobes. And basically, if you sort of dig into that crevice, which we're going to do in the next slide, that's where the inside of the body is sort of represented. So you can go to the next slide and you can see that when that lateral sulcus is sort of peeled apart, what you find is the insular cortex. There's a whole layer of cortex in there. And that's really, I mean, the sense of taste is there, but it's also just considered this general interoception. So if you have people, I mean, I use neuroimaging methods, so that's one way to get at this, but basically when people are thinking about what's happening inside their body, mm-hmm. or paying attention to their internal feelings, this part of cortex is going to be sort of sensitive to that, and it's going to become more active. So there's, you know, this part of cortex has a very complex role, and so saying it does interoception and sense of taste, it's a little bit, it's interesting, right? The inside of the body is super complex, and it's almost not as neatly organized as the external sort of sense of touch. And so there's a lot of investigation and exploration going around, trying to understand what this part of the brain does. But one of the things it does seem to be involved in is when people are paying attention to the inside of their body. Hmm. So, I think,
Do you have an example for that? Like, what do you mean? Like when they're paying attention to the inside of their body?
Just if they were focused on basically like, how does your stomach feel right now? Okay. Or like focusing on the breathing, mm-hmm. some sort of processes like how the inside of the body really feels.
Got it. Okay.
It's kind of interesting. It's also a difficult brain region to study. So one of the ways that we study which parts of the brain do what is mm-hmm. is just by if people happen to get injuries to their brain and then they lose a certain function and we're like, oh, okay, so that part of the brain must do this. But right. The insula, it's so tucked inside there that it doesn't get injured very often.
Right.
and so it's hard to really have, you know, in part, it's just our lack of knowledge, but it also seems to be just laid out in a complex way that we still, you know, as the field of neuroscience, we're still trying to really understand what that part of the brain does. Mm-hmm. If the somatosensory cortex is responsible for what's happening outside the surface of the skin, this part of the brain is going to be tracking sort of what's happening inside the surface of the skin, which is obviously a totally different sensation.
Right. Yeah.
Oftentimes, it's sort of a less detailed representation, at least for a lot of people. But again, this kind of goes back to how much people are paying attention to those sensations. Uh-huh. Some people are way more sensitive to what's going on inside their bodies versus others. So I'm sure that plays a role as well.
Yeah.
So we can go ahead to the next slide. Okay. So I just I wanted to go back to the visual system. This is where I've done most of my work has been with respect to visual cues, although I did spend some time studying music as well. So the auditory system I've spent some time there as well. But the visual system represents faces and bodies in a sort of very specific way. And so obviously, like our normal sense of the symmetry of the body and how the size of the head versus the body in terms of what we see is different than that homunculus, which is in terms of what we feel. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of the normal aesthetic of the visual body is going to be sort of governed by this part of the brain. And especially if you go to the next slide, it's really once the information comes in the very back of the brain, it just starts to sort of bounce forward down through the temporal lobe through this area called this whole pathway called the visual ventral stream, which is really responsible more generally for identifying objects.
Okay. And so it travels this way?
Yeah.
Straightforward? Yep. Okay.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So along the bottom of the temporal lobe. So we'll on the next slide, we'll sort of look at the brain from the bottom. You can go ahead and click on that.
From the bottom, and then this is from the side.
Yep, exactly. Okay. Exactly. And so this is from a paper by a neuroscientist named Nancy Kamischer, who spent a lot of time thinking about different modules in the visual system and what they represent. So you can see the little green areas that represent bodies. So basically, if you're watching a visual scene and a body shows up, the neurons in these regions will start to increase their firing rate. And that's part of, you know, the experience of seeing a body. Mm-hmm. And then if there's a face, you'll get, these regions in the purple, and versus places, you'll get these sort of regions in the magenta, et cetera, and so on and so forth. So basically, the visual system is sort of, especially this ventral visual stream, the bottom of the visual system is keeping track of different objects, and bodies are one of those objects. So it's the research on perceptually sort of seeing bodies hasn't so much explored people looking at their own bodies, which obviously I think is just, it involves a lot of different like psychology there. People have, how people react to an image of their own body is gonna involve a lot of emotions and just your perception of the self. A lot of people, when they see pictures of themselves or even when they hear themselves recorded, will have this sort of, it's almost like an error detection thing where they're like, well, it's like an expectancy violation. Like, I didn't think that's what I was going to look like, right? Especially with the auditory, because you sound different from inside your own head. It is
so when I first launched, first off, are we done with the slides?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm going to stop sharing this. So it's just back to us. You're so right. Because when I first launched the podcast almost a year ago, and I listened to a couple of the episodes, I'm like, that's my voice. Like, I was like, whoa.
Yeah. It's really quite an experience.
Mm-hmm. So my question with that is, does it go into because of how we hear our own self versus like a recording of ourselves? Does it go into the fact of like how we feel the vibration of our voice and hear it at the same time? So more of that internal sensory and that outernal sensory at the same time?
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, when you hear your own voice, like, yeah, your ear is going to detect the vibrations, and they're just coming from a different place.
Yeah.
So like, it's not, your voice isn't coming from out there. And so your whole body is kind of filtering it in a way, right? Like you know, your throat is, you know, the sound is just going directly from your throat to your ear in a way. That vibration is going to be translated just through the body. It's like an error because it doesn't sound like you. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting how it doesn't happen. You know, when I hear recordings of other people talking,
right?
And I'm like, oh yeah, that sounds like them.
Yeah. You know, so
it takes some time getting used to. I've spent some time in working in a recording studio, and it takes a long time to get used to. I'm sure you're used to it by now, though. You've probably listened to your...
Sometimes I'll listen to my, like, the shows. I'm like, oh, that's still me. I'm still not used to it.
Yeah. No, it definitely takes a while. So I think with the audition, that's just like sort of an error detection mechanism because it's just not what you're used to. And then the same can translate to visual pictures of photos, although that's a little bit more variable between people, I think, because obviously how you look in a photo and how you look in the mirror is fairly comparable. I mean, how we represent, how we think we look, and then how we look, how we think we sound, and then how we sound. Mm-hmm. That mismatch is going to sort of be detected by the brain, and that's a whole nother circuit that will sort of detect that mismatch and sort of propagate through the system. Yeah, yeah.
So when you say mismatch, is it more just because it's an outer body interpretation of ourself?
Yeah, yeah.
Versus like looking at a mirror, and you're also dealing with like your feelings of like you're feeling good or not feeling good, or just like your outfit or whatnot, where versus a picture, if you just took that picture, maybe some pictures are good about capturing the emotions, but sometimes it's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
So is it just because of like that mismatch is like, we don't have that embodied feeling of how we look when we see those things or hear some of those things?
Yeah. I mean, if you think about too, just the, just how new the technology is, like from an evolutionary standpoint, it's just, it's kind of, you know, the brain didn't like, it wasn't sort of designed to like see a frozen version of yourself, you know, like we're so, the brain is so used to a dynamic experience that seeing something that's frozen, especially a person that's frozen, is sort of relatively new for our species.
Yeah.
You know? Everybody, unless somebody, even when someone's sleeping, you know, they're still in motion. Mm-hmm. And in photographs, there's a lot of sort of implied motion. You know, your brain kind of fills that in. And you could imagine even that is sort of like that is sort of an error in and of itself, where it's just like, okay, why is this frozen? Obviously, we're used to it by now.
Right.
You know, people look at photos all the time. It's just kind of part of our daily life. And it's interesting, you know, for people our age, it's that you know, when I was a kid, before Facebook and everything, it's like, spend that much time looking at photos.
Right.
And I just feel like looking at photos is just such a commonplace everyday activity that we're sort of used to it now. And certainly, I mean, people who are posting a lot of photos of themselves in particular on Facebook or Instagram, they probably just, they're so habituated to it. They probably, it's just like seeing themselves in the mirror, you know?
Yeah, it's been fascinating kind of growing up with the wave of Facebook. I mean, I remember when Facebook came out in college.
Yeah.
Before, I used to love doing like scrapbooks with photographs and like having that kinesthetic and experience with like the photos, where now it's just like cut and paste screened stuff. What do you know about some of the technology that has evolved with where we are today and the effects of brain, and does it limit the kinesthetic learning aspect?
That's a really good question. And certainly I would say there's some evidence that it limits the learning experience. And there's been some research on like what's called kind of embodied learning, or, so teaching kids chemistry by actually having them sort of like physically play with physical models of the molecules, that kind of thing. I mean, you get the more sensory domains that are involved in the learning, the better the learning is going to be. I mean, in terms of how the technology is changing our brains, that research is still emerging, but certainly it seems to have affected people's attention spans. Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, there's some exceptions, you know, I know a lot of people, because there's also a counterculture to it where people kind of reject the technology, almost they've maintained certain skills of being able to pay attention to the world around them, essentially.
Right.
But the technology has an addictive quality. It's designed to be that way. Mm-hmm. Twitter or Facebook, they have algorithms that are going to show you exactly what they think you want to see, because they need you to keep coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Those motor programs, it starts to become automatic. And when it becomes automatic, it's actually coming out of that willful sort of motor strip.
Oh, interesting.
And it's going to be a lower circuit, a subcortical circuit that is more involved in habitual behavior and also addiction. Uh-huh. So, you know, once it gets down there, it's just, you know, I think it's pretty well understood just how difficult it is to break an addiction of any kind.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is like a heavy topic, because with like being in an online business and always doing social media and like this type of thing, like some of my girlfriends and I have talked about, like, how do we keep a healthy approach to this? Because this can be addicting. And there has been times where I've been like, just out of habit, I just pick up my phone and my thumb goes directly to Facebook or Instagram. Mm-hmm. And then I'm just like staring and I'm like, what am I doing on my phone?
Yeah.
Like, I was going to like calculate something or check my email or take a picture. Like it just goes into automatic mode. And where I have had to, like, one thing that's helped me is like setting timelines of like, this is when I'm on social media, and just some of those boundaries. But what other advice do you have for people? I mean, because this is the world that we live in. I mean, every company is going on to Facebook for advertising now. Like, it's the billboard of any type of business. What advice do you have for people who are in business with this type of stuff, or who even aren't, but may notice like some of this addicting behavior? What are some ways that we can trick the brain into getting more of a healthy relationship with some of these technologies that we live in today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really great question. I mean, I think I do resonate with you where it's kind of, it's just necessary from a business standpoint. Like, I do so much work on the computer. I'm always on my email during work for work correspondence. And so, you know, you can't cut yourself off completely. Mm-hmm. And it's a similar, I mean, it's a similar problem with, I think, with food. I mean, people have addictions to food, but you can't cut it off completely.
Right.
You just got to learn to like interact with it in a healthy way. And so a lot of the strategies that have been developed for food addictions, I think, could also work, can also kind of be translated in a way. I mean, I can say from my own personal experience, I've definitely had that the same experience that you described, where all of a sudden I was on Facebook and I'm like, how did I even, if this happens so fast, like, why am I even on here?
Right.
And so what I did was I just created, you know, you can like, have all your app windows, and then you can slide to the right and have a new page of apps. Mm-hmm. And so I just created it. So I had to slide across four different windows and then I have it embedded in like a little subfolder. And I labeled the subfolder like, ignore this. like, you know, right, with some like message for myself.
Right.
And so it would take me, in order to open it, was, I did it for Facebook and Twitter, and it's really helped. I have, you know, now with all the screen time metrics, I know that my habits have improved a lot.
Yeah.
Like, it would take me like an extra 10 seconds to open the app. Mm-hmm. And just by like extending the time window by that much, it gave me a chance for my conscious brain to just be like, wait a second, do I really want to go here right now?
Right.
And so that made that was just like a little strategy that made a difference.
No, that's great.
Yeah.
That's awesome. In
any way that you can kind of distance it from yourself.
Right.
That gives you that time to just think about what you're doing instead of just, playing to these sort of automatic.
Right.
Comes this automatic motor thing, you know, you just, to pick up the phone, it's sort of, it becomes a compulsion really quickly, you know, because these devices are just a huge part of our life at this point.
Let's dive back to the body though. So you have listened to a couple episodes, and one of the things I'm really intrigued about is where the trauma is stored in the body and how the brain interprets that. And one of the conversations I had after the show with a guest is how we were talking about the homologous and how we were just sharing each other's stories of injuries. And there was a bike accident that I had where I fell off my bike and literally there was no skin on my hands. He's like, that's probably why your brain can handle so much trauma. And I'm like, what? Where did this come from? And he's like, well, just think about it. So I'm curious of what the physical, just like physical injuries, if that almost like strengthens our brain to be like, oh, we can handle this type of trauma, or almost impacts us to understand how to develop or manage pain better.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. And actually, the pain, so in, you know, in the external body there, you know, I talked about the receptors for the sense of touch.
Right.
And those are actually, that's actually a separate pathway from the pathway of the pain receptors.
Okay. And so
pain is actually processed by a different set of receptors, and it goes up a different pathway to a different part of the brain. And it's just, it's not, it, you know, these are, they're really sort of responding to inflammation. I mean, as soon as you get an injury, right, you get all those white blood cells. And so it's detecting the presence of those and sending these pain signals. The sense of touch actually interferes with that. And that's why if you get an injury and you kind of rub it, it makes it feel a little better.
Okay.
Because that signal will actually kind of interfere with the pain signal.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah. they're two sort of parallel pathways.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, this idea, there's definitely something to this idea that by experiencing injury, you can get a sense of your own resilience.
Right.
But then there's also, you know, I think there is a line where it becomes traumatic. Where an injury is traumatic and it can have, you know, sort of like negative consequences where instead of feeling stronger, you start to feel afraid of doing certain things.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, that there are different personalities and it depends on the severity of the injury. I mean, I used to play soccer, when I was in high school and I had two major knee surgeries. One when I was 14, one when I was 16.
Yeah.
And I came back from both of them. And I remember even with the second one, I almost quit, but I just was like, I'm going to stop playing when I'm done with high school, but I don't want the injury to be what ends my career. And so I ended up going back. But then later, you know, I moved to Vermont for grad school and I was so afraid to try downhill snow skiing.
Oh, interesting.
It was like something totally new. Even though I had gone back and played soccer, you know, it was just, I had this hesitation. Eventually I overcame that fear. The last year I lived there, I thought snow skiing, but
yeah,
it was all fine. But it certainly, it was like, yeah, even though I knew that I was proud of myself for making it through the injury and recovering through the injury, but there was still some, I guess, like trauma left over.
Right.
That was like, you know, I don't want to have to go through that again.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So I think it can go both ways. And, you know, but even with that experience of not, of being afraid, you know, I just, it kind of gave me another opportunity to overcome the fear.
Right.
And so I think that there are multiple ways to look at it. Yeah, certainly if you experience an injury, physical pain is a huge signal to the brain. Mm-hmm. And what the brain is going to do is it's going to try to understand all the different components that are going on that led to the pain so that you can avoid it next time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it learns. Like it wants to protect you.
Right.
So, you know, it's just, it's going to sort of say, well, what was the pattern that led to this pain? And then that, you know, especially if it's chronic, if you get some sort of chronic injury situation, it's going to lead to some sort of avoidance patterns. Which again, if it's habitual enough, you get it goes down into these lower brain circuits where the avoidance pattern becomes very habitual.
Well, and I have a couple questions about fear and like what you're just talking about. So how do we train the brain, similar to what the example that you gave about the downhill snow skiing, allowing our body to be like, no, you're safe. The knee is strong. We can do this. What type of tactics do you have that doesn't eliminate the brain or like that body signal of like of fear? Because there are times of like this, we need that fear to be healthy, right?
Yeah.
So where's that balance of like when we do need a fear? I can't think of an example right now, but versus a past memory and fear comes up.
Yeah. I mean, that I think it can be, I think it can be really hard. I think the one of the keys is kind of baby steps. Mm-hmm. And so like, certainly for me with the snow skiing example,
right,
I had to start on something very simple. And then once I realized I could do that, then kind of go to the next step rather than just kind of diving in.
Uh-huh.
And I think by taking the baby steps, it was kind of respecting the fear rather than being in denial of it or trying to.
That's true.
Like,
that's good.
I think that there's a, there's, it, certainly, it's sort of a normal reaction to get frustrated with your fear.
Right.
You know, like I certainly feel that way. Even when, you know, when I'm giving a talk or a presentation, it's just like, why am I afraid of this right now? Like,
right.
And in that's a case where there's no possible injury. Just, it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
But it's hard to, I think I would say if you're just going to, it's a bad idea to just ignore the fear and kind of pretend it's not there, push it away. You know, it's like, you've got to face it and acknowledge that it's there. Otherwise it's kind of going to just keep coming up in bigger ways, I would say.
Yeah. Well, and I think what you said about respecting it,
taking
those baby steps and kind of retraining the brain of like, it's okay versus like, just like, nope, we're just going to go for it. Like balls to the walls. Here we go.
Yeah.
Cause then it just, it almost it seems like, and I speak from experience with my water skiing days of just like, ignore the times that I have ignored the pain or push my body to the limit too quickly, then it almost in my mind that circuit of like, yeah, you do need to be fearful because you pushed yourself too much and you crashed really hard. Mm-hmm, it just like cements that fear in your brain a little bit more versus those small baby approaches or baby steps.
Right. Yeah. It's almost like just kind of ignoring it completely. The voice will just get louder, you know, in some sense, but, it's, you know, there's some wisdom in fear, you know, it's there, it's like, it's there for a reason. And it's not there to hurt you. It's there it's kind of the survival instinct. Mm-hmm. Fear is about preserving safety. And so as I think to the degree that, you know, if you're aware of it and you can consciously access it, you can kind of communicate with that part of yourself, you know, almost kind of talk to yourself in that sense, like acknowledge that the fear is there and explicitly tell yourself, you know, this is okay. And I'm going to do this. And then, you know, it's then there's some exposure therapy in that process where, you know, it's just kind of like exposure. I don't know if you know the term exposure therapy, but it's how people with specific phobias are often treated. So like if somebody had a, you know, really bad phobia of spiders, the exposure therapy, first they would, you know, show you the word spider and you know, the therapist would be there to kind of hold your hand.
Right. They don't just throw a spider on you.
Like a cartoon spider. And, you know, and just kind of slowly graduate up to the real thing.
Right.
And so, yeah, exposure therapy is all about those baby steps. And because otherwise, if you were just gave someone with a spider phobia, like a full live spider, it would just re-traumatize them.
Yeah,
you know, it wouldn't fix anything. with the small steps and then having another person, to be there to support you can really help with the emotion of fear. And having that sort of confirmation from somebody else, it's just sort of almost like some sort of mother figure, father figure therapy. Yeah. Figure kind of thing. Because a lot of times, especially if the fear is super irrational and you don't really know where it's coming from, that is usually a signal that it's probably coming from somewhere in childhood and you might not be able to pinpoint exactly where it's coming from. And so if you can kind of, like it's almost like relive that experience, but have somebody there as a safety signal, as a safety figure, that can have a huge impact on people's ability to overcome that emotion. Fear is really hard to move through on your own. And having social support can be extremely beneficial, I would say. Yeah.
With that, I want to dive into the mirroring aspect with how, and what I mean by mirroring for those who are listening, of just how our bodies naturally want to mirror each other. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I do with clients, for those who are familiar with this, is the FMS screen. And one of the things that they do is we don't demonstrate the movement. We just want to see what the client or the student's natural movement is. So we'll talk it through because we don't want them to try to copy our movement just from watching it.
Interesting.
And so with what you're saying about having that social support when facing fear, how important is it for the other person to not have the same fear or to mirror that safety for that person who's working through that fear or that trauma? So they're not like stumbling on each other.
Yeah, no, I think that that would be hugely important. Like you, it can't just be any person. It has
right.
to be someone you trust in someone. Maybe, you know, if they feel the fear, if they were able to hide it well enough, like maybe. But people are pretty sensitive, you know. You
right.
can that. I mean, it still kind of changes the experience to be afraid together with another person. Mm. Think like watching a horror movie together or something. Or it changes the experience in a certain way, but if it's real life fear, like something traumatic that you're trying to overcome that's from the past, I would say, yeah, you would want to work through it with somebody who has, who can almost be like a role model in terms of, sort of exuding that confidence. Mm-hmm. And then the mimicry that you're talking about is very powerful. I mean, one of the easiest ways to learn how to do something is to mimic.
Yeah.
Even with simple motor movements, but also with like professional things. Like I'm sure as you're learning to have your own podcast, you look at other people who are doing podcasts.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
How do they do it?
Yeah.
And so mimicry is extremely powerful. And if you have, somebody with a strong emotional base that you can mimic, it's just going to be way easier to learn just in the way that mimicry is just an effective learning mechanism in general.
Yeah. I mean, like back in when I was playing sports, people could coach me up with words all day. Uh-huh. And then if I watch a professional athlete, like I would watch it and then be like, okay, I want to do it now. Like just seeing it, that my body's like, okay, let's do it. Like, let's go do this versus like that coaching and everything is like, yeah, you could talk me up all day long. But once I see what I'm supposed to do, I get so much more motivated, so much more drive, so much more like eagerness to do it versus like, I started running again and I was at a club or like a group running thing. And there was one kid who just zoomed around the track. And then like that next time I went, I was like on fire. It felt so much more like there was like another pep in my step or anything like that. But it's so fascinating that I don't know if it's an energy transfer or just that mirroring aspect of like knowing you can do and seeing it being done in someone else gets that motivation for other people.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I know, so there's a lot of work on these types of brain circuits called mirror neurons.
Right.
This term. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting though, because it's usually that research is just based on sort of simple actions and not really, they don't really tie it into the motivation piece that you were talking about. And so I think it's really fascinating that you have that experience. And I think it makes sense that to see someone else do it makes you understand that it's very possible.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's all in the abstract and in words, it's just less real. And it's, there's a little bit less certainty in terms of whether or not it's possible or how exactly it's going to look. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as soon as you see someone actually carrying out the action, that it's like the possibility of it becomes more tangible for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Going back to the mirror stuff within our brains, yeah. I know one of the things that we were talking about beforehand, before we started recording, is going back to kind of like that person who's holding that supportive place for someone going through either fear or working through some stuff. Uh-huh. How does that one person not take on the other emotion from the other person?
Yeah. I think it just requires part of that emotional strength.
Yeah.
Requires a very strong sense of identity. Mm-hmm. And I think if a person has that strong sense of identity, that can sort of keep them rooted in a way where they can sort of experience the other person's emotion, mm-hmm. but remains kind of distant from it.
Yeah.
I think for any sort of therapy or coaching practice, mm-hmm. you know, you're gonna have to look at other people's emotions.
Right. Yeah. Looking at
them, you're gonna, you know, there's this just mechanism where you kind of look at it with your body, you know, like, yeah. you experience it a little bit.
Mm-hmm. There's been times with conversations that I've had where I'm like, my body's reacting to their emotions and I don't know how to do it. Like, why is my body taking this on right now?
I've definitely had that experience too. And I've been getting better at it, but I certainly went in my younger days when I didn't really understand that that's what was happening.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even realize that it wasn't my emotion. Like, I just kind of thought that it was, you know, it was mine.
Right.
And so it took some practice to be like, okay, this is not my experience. Like, I'm mirroring something that they're experiencing. Mm-hmm. But it can still be very difficult, and I've and almost to the point where I would just have to kind of avoid interacting with certain people, because it's like, I know if I interact with this person that this is how they experience their emotions, and I'm gonna feel that. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I don't, from my personal experience, like, I hesitate to just, I don't wanna shut people out. And certainly if you have clients, it's like you are in it to sort of face their problems with them.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's, I can imagine that it would be challenging for people in the sort of coaching and therapy professions to distance themselves from their clients' problems. I think that that's pretty, a pretty common problem in those professions. People just get really wrapped up. And my intuition is that it's really just having your own sense of identity, mm-hmm. and staying grounded in that, and, you know, focusing on the self-care. And, you know, once you're done interacting with a particular client, you just kind of go back to yourself, go back to your inner space, and kind of reclaim it in a way. Mm-hmm. I know that that's still kind of talking in the abstract, but and I'm sure that there are a bunch of different strategies to do it. You know, everybody has their own strategy for sort of centering themselves, or mm-hmm. or getting in the zone, or you know, whatever phrase they have for that sort of process. And I think that just doing that is important. To not make other people's problems your own, because mm-hmm. at the end of the day, I don't think that really helps them.
Oh, anyway. No.
So no. It's no. Just kind of, yeah. But it's hard, you know, people, especially people who are just naturally very empathic, uh-huh. they just, you know, when they're in the room with someone, they just feel how that person is feeling. And it's almost this automatic process. For other people though, like, there are other people who would say, like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, you know, they just kind of don't have an intuition for empathy, and they kind of don't, you know, and then there are problems that go along with that, right? Like, not understanding on people's emotions, that has its own set of problems.
Can you quickly, before you keep going, just explain empath? I know some listeners know that, but some may be new to that word.
Yeah. So there are sort of two components of empathy is sort of considered to have two different components. One being more cognitive, and kind of just in general perspective taking. So this is like somebody who's like really good at like marketing or sales or something, they know what the other person is feeling exactly, but they don't feel it themselves necessarily. They just know how to navigate that system. So that's called perspective taking. And that's one component of empathy.
Uh-huh.
The other component being the sort of emotional care for others. And it's like you have an emotional investment in how someone else is feeling and a desire to mitigate their suffering.
Mm.
And so, and then people with that sort of intention and motivation, you know, may or may not be very good at the perspective taking. Like sometimes you could be, but like the perspective taking is more of like the cognitive strategy and knowing exactly what to do to sort of have an influence on the other person's emotion, mm-hmm. for good or for bad, you know, right? And then the emotional piece is like that real desire to influence another person's emotions such that they feel better or they suffer less.
Yeah. And going back to the mirror neurons.
Yeah, mirror neurons.
That's what I'm thinking of. It's late as we're recording this. it's at the end of the day. What's the significance of just a smile and changing someone's emotions with the mirror neurons?
Yeah. Well, so you could imagine. So with the smile, obviously, there's a mimicry piece to it. So usually when you smile at someone, they'll often smile back at you.
Right.
And then when you smile, there's actually a nice quote by a Buddhist monk named Thich Nhat Hanh. And he said, smiling is yoga for the mouth.
I love it.
And it kind of is this piece where you do the motor movement, but you also physically feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And that motor movement has associations. And so it's associated with all of these times that you were happy.
Mm.
And so it can sort of, that motor movement can kind of bleed in, or it can just kind of, you know, the way that neurons are connected, it can just, that activity can kind of trace back to these other memories or other moments that, you know, it might not come to the surface immediately. It might be a sort of subtle effect, but just having that smile is enough to kind of, can be enough to kind of soften just the entire disposition of a person in the moment. It's not like you can just walk around with a smile on your face all day and then that's the answer to everything.
What does that be, easy though?
but certainly I think it's particularly effective if like somebody doesn't expect it, you know,
right.
And all of a sudden you smile at them and it, you know, that element of surprise is really going to play a big role in how much of an emotional experience someone has in response to that smile.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Awesome. Going back to the brain.
Yeah, yeah.
So the brain, we have the brain, and mm-hmm. then we have the brain in our gut and the brain in our heart.
Yeah.
Do you think the hands and the homologus is another aspect of our brain, or is it just the interconnection between the brain body?
It's a hard question to answer. I mean, the brain, obviously, it's considered an isolated organ, but
right.
You know, like in the gut, you know, there's actual cortical tissue. And in the heart, there's also cortical tissue, and there's other organs like the thymus, which is kind of near the heart. It has cortical layers in it. And so it's kind of, you know, I hear about people talk about other species of animals like the octopus, and they're like, oh, the octopus has like 8 brains or whatever. I forget how many brains it has.
Uh-huh.
But I kind of see the human body is kind of like that too, in that we kind of have a brain in our heart. There's literal cortical tissue there.
Right.
In our gut. So people don't, you know, from a strict like anatomy standpoint, people don't call that the brain.
Mm-hmm.
But and because of that labeling, we don't really understand the role of these cortical tissues that are out in the periphery.
Okay.
And so that I think is a huge area for exploration for the field of neuroscience. But like mm-hmm. a neuroscientist I think in this day and age would be, would, you know, wouldn't necessarily gravitate towards studying the cortical tissue of the heart or the gut. I mean, certainly there's a huge, influx of research on the gut microbiome,
right,
and how that relates to neural activity. But it still is sort of measured, you know, what's being measured is sort of the content of the bacteria, not necessarily the function of the actual function of that.
Okay.
And how that's sort of interconnected. But yeah, there's a lot of, you know, our whole, the whole organism is sensitive, mm-hmm. And there's information, you know, in all the different, in all the different systems, in the respiratory system, the circulatory system, and how those signals kind of feed into the central nervous system and how they're processed. Mm-hmm. There's still a lot of mystery there. And I think that, there's a lot of information processing that is usually attributed to the brain that is actually happening in the periphery. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I would say that the brain body connection is throughout the body.
There's a lot to be explored.
Yes, definitely.
What are you currently working on with your research, if you're able to share?
Yeah, so I have a lot of different projects going on right now, but the lab I'm working in, we specifically study the self and how people represent themselves, how what the brain is doing when people are thinking about themselves. And so that's something that people do very often. They're just kind of reflecting on themselves. And in particular, the tasks that we use are related to words. And so, you know, a word like friendly, how much does that describe you? Or a word like organized, or a word like, you know, different traits. And if people are thinking about whether or not that word applies to them, there's a certain network of brain regions that's usually involved in that process, called the default mode network. And so we are exploring basically how does that network represent information about the self and about other people, and trying to figure out exactly how we do that. How do we keep track of who we are and who other people are? Yeah. So I have another study that that I'm working on where instead of using words, it's people looking at actual photographs. Mm-hmm. And so they look at a portrait yearbook photo of themselves, mm-hmm. and then also similar photos of their friends that they know on varying degrees of familiarity. So people who they know really well, people who they know kind of, people who they've never seen before. So we have this whole range to try to see how does the brain, you know, what parts of the brain are specialized for processing the self, mm-hmm. and what parts of the brain are sort of tracking this dimension of familiarity. Familiarity, you know, it plays a role in this safety signal. People tend to feel safe around people that they're familiar with. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to be a whole neural circuit that comes online that reflects that sort of emotional feeling. And so I'm still working through the data now. I don't really have any answers. But because it's a photo, and at the very beginning we were talking about that sort of seeing yourself outside yourself.
Uh-huh.
There does seem to be a little bit, some of the first analyses that I ran seem to suggest that there is a little bit of an error signal seeing the self. Mm. But I also, in some of the images, I have people making particular facial expressions.
Uh-huh.
And so one of the expressions that I've been really interested in is surprise.
Yeah.
And people, surprise is just a really interesting emotion because it can be positive or negative, and people have different biases in terms of which way that they go with surprise. But, you know, I have people looking at themselves making a surprise face. And so that error detection signal is going to be, you know, that's like an unusual thing to see. You usually see a picture of yourself smiling.
Right.
So you get some of that, like, that error correction network coming online when people are seeing that photo.
Oh, interesting.
So I'm still exploring those data and just trying to figure out, what's sort of happening when people see themselves. I'm going to start working with some more data along these lines. And in particular, it's actually a study with a population of adolescent girls. And they, in part of the study, they kind of have this short video where they just, it's like, take a minute or two to just describe yourself. And I think the way it was framed, it was like, imagine that they're selecting people for a reality TV show. Like, how would you can talk about who you are and things from your past and what you're like.
Yeah.
And so I'm really interested in exploring these data because we also have mental health outcomes on these girls. And so, you know, they've gone through psychiatric interviews and we can see kind of how that symptomology plays out in these girls as they talk about themselves and sort of as they're going through development. So yeah, there's this whole piece of how the brain represents the self, but also how does that emerge over time? And to do that, you kind of have to look at those processes in younger kids.
Right.
And so that's sort of another piece of it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you, with the research that you're doing right now, are you diving into any aspect of how us humans do a lot of self-sabotage through this?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. So self-sabotage is pretty hard to measure. I mean, a lot of people are even unaware of it when they do it.
Right.
That would be a super interesting topic, and especially to get at that, you know, as it emerges across the lifespan. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think I would say self-sabotage is definitely going to be related to these fear circuits, and like really it's kind of fear of success. And so, you know, if, you know, people are afraid of failure, but people are also really afraid of success.
And you're so right. Cause I remember talking to one of my friends and I was like, it's not fear of failing. I could fail all day. It's the fact of like, for example, with water skiing, one of my nicknames that I coined myself was Anna Splash. I'm like, I'm fine falling.
Nice.
It's like going around all the buoys that terrifies me and like making the run and being successful at it, because then you have to level up. Like you still have to continue going forward, and it takes on a different type of responsibility, I believe, that you have to evolve into and change for. So going back to this self-sabotage, is it a way of people staying stuck with where they're at so they don't have to change with the success that life brings them?
Yeah. I would say that's a really good way of putting it. Because there is, you know, fear, success carries a lot with it, you know? Yeah. And so it's really, maybe it's not so much fear of the success, but fear of the consequences of success, which is, you know, sort of the same thing, or will lead to the same sort of self-sabotaging behaviors.
What do you mean by the consequences of success?
Like you were saying, the responsibility.
Oh, got it. Okay. Yeah.
Continuing to move forward.
Because
I mean, it can change things a lot, and you have to be ready for that change. Again, I think this is where mentorship can be really helpful, or having a person that can help guide you through that. Just to recognize patterns of self-sabotage, I think is a real victory, because that's something that people kind of, you know, you can see people sort of go through life and they kind of stay stuck in a certain place. And I think that's sort of it's a way of fear sort of manifesting itself, you know, fear of change, fear of success.
So what do you have any advice of, there you go. There's some more light for you.
The sun is going down.
Yeah, so. I was wondering, we're just, for those who are listening, we're commenting on her lighting aspect, which is a brighter spot for the video. What are some tips that you have for people to just bring that awareness of self-sabotage and ways to get out of it? I know you mentioned mentoring, and sometimes that helps. I think sometimes, though, it's maybe the motivation or the reason behind it. Or I think sometimes it maybe go back to like some trauma that we don't even realize that is a pattern in our life. Like, what advice do you have for people to kind of get out of that patterning and into a new one?
I mean, anything you can do to develop your confidence and develop that sense of identity and who you are. It's sort of that same strategy for not taking on other people's emotions. Yeah. It's almost like you could almost see that fear, the fear that's causing the self-sabotage, you know, especially if it's coming from a younger age, you can almost treat it like it's someone else's emotion, you know, like it's like you as a child.
Yeah.
And I think really working through or learning how to, face that underlying emotion is really what's going to lead to different behavioral patterns. Mm-hmm. And it would be similar to just overcoming fear of after an injury or something. You know, it's like you have to be patient with it. Mm-hmm. You have to respect it. But at the same time, nobody wants fear to control them. Or to sort of control their behavior.
Where does the risk playing come into that? Like, there's been times with like my entrepreneurial life.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, I got to jump.
Like, yeah.
It's risky, but we got to jump. Yeah. Yeah. Where's a point where like with some of this repatterning, where you have to take some of those risks?
Yeah. I think that's really hard. It's really hard. And I'm sure like, you know, in some of that you have to learn from experience, because that risk taking can be a self-sabotaging thing, like taking unnecessary risks, or that you don't have to take. It can be a way of self-sabotaging, but there are risks that you have to take. And so where do you draw that line, and how do you know which risks are intelligent and which risks are, you know, a bad idea?
Yeah.
I mean, that just takes experience, like, you know, and just kind of this self-knowledge where you can say, oh, you know, you can, if you recognize the pattern of self-sabotage, then you can kind of see that that's what it is. Mm. But yeah, like I will certainly see, I can see myself in doing things sometimes where I'm taking risks and I think I'm being bold, but I'm really being reckless. and being reckless is kind of a self-sabotage. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And it looks very different because it's not, it seems brave and it's not based on fear, but it's really kind of like, another layer to that fear, where it's like the frustration with the fear leads to recklessness. And so it's still kind of built on top of the fear in a certain way.
Interesting.
So I think if you can trace the risk-taking back to the fear, versus is the risk-taking about, what it's going to lead to.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I don't know. I think it's sort of digging into the motivations that are underlying the action.
Right. Yeah.
And then once you see the emotions that are under that, it will be, you know, it can be a little bit easier to identify whether or not, it's really a healthy risk or not.
Uh-huh. Fascinating. Interesting. Awesome. Well, you have so much knowledge. We may have to have you on again as like
round two or something.
Definitely.
That'd be awesome. I'm really happy to share. I'm so glad you found it useful.
Oh yeah, this is great. And I've talked to a couple of my friends or when I was in psychology program at the grad school, one of the frustrations was the fact that there was no imaging about the brain and just basic science about the brain. So I was super excited to bring you on and to share just the physical aspect of what happens in our brain when we move, so we understand more of that mind-body connection.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you would like to share for the listeners?
Just thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for having me on. This has been super fun. You ask such great questions. I mean, I love your podcast. They're all really hard questions, really make me think, and I love how you dig into the personal aspect of it, and have the courage to really talk about these tough questions. It's really awesome.
Well, that's where my mind goes, so I just gotta go with it. Well, Allison, thank you so much. And strong ones, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure you share it out to your family and friends and share the love with the 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Other than that, I'll be back next week. Peace out.